Welcome to the EFAX Corporate Podcast. You can find related podcasts, videos, webinars, and other educational content on our website, enterprise.efax.com. If you have questions related to today's conversation or a suggestion for a future podcast, please email us at corporatesupport@mail.efax.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Good morning and good afternoon, and welcome to today's webinar, Cyber Hacking in Healthcare and Best Practices for Securing ePHI. I'm Carol Fly with Hightech Answers, and we're pleased to be partnering once again with EFAX Corporate on a continuing series of thought leadership events.
Great. Well, thank you, Carol, very much for the introductions. This is Michael Flavin from J2 Global. Before we begin, we have two Michaels today, so to try and make it clear, Michael Flavin will remain the Michael of the group, and Mike Pearson will be Mike for the duration of the presentation so that you can understand the difference between who's speaking. One other housekeeping item. The information provided in this presentation does not constitute and is no substitute for legal or other professional advice. So we strongly encourage you to consult your own legal or other professional advisors for individualized guidance regarding the application of the law to your particular situation and in any connection with compliance-related concerns. Cyber hacking in healthcare, a snapshot. According to Data Breach Today, the Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights has reported that 1,999 incidents involving 41.5 million people have occurred as of January 2015, while the top five data breaches in 2014 totaled 7.4 million people. And this year alone, that number has skyrocketed to an astounding 90 million individuals and is continuing to grow. That ups the tally for the federal records of individuals affected by major breaches reportable under HIPAA since 2009 to 130 million plus individuals, resulting in a mind-boggling 1,800% increase. Breaches in the last 90 days alone should put healthcare providers and insurers on notice. As you may already know, the depth of this problem has prompted the FBI to issue flash warning to the healthcare industry that malicious actors are using malware to target ePHI and intellectual property, such as device and equipment manufacturers and development data. So why is all of this happening? Well, healthcare entities are a veritable treasure trove of information for would-be hackers, because the data includes names, birth dates, social security numbers, credit card numbers, claims information, and clinical data, for example, all of which can be easily resold on the black market by criminals looking to commit identity theft. Mike, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. This is Mike Pearson. We're going to have a little bit of a back and forth here, but I'm going to weigh in on some of these topics, and I think it's really important what you're bringing up there. I was just reading some additional information this morning about the latest Blue Cross breach that took place within the last couple of days, and the amount of information is just staggering, and we're going to go over a lot of different topics here. One of the first things we're going to go over is why do some of these data breaches occur, and then we can dig down into how they occur and what are some of the defensive shields you can throw up, if you will, to help prevent data loss of ePHI.
Great. Thanks, Mike. So Mike, now that we've talked a little bit about the why, and we'll delve into that, what about the who of cybercrime? What are the sources of all of these breaches?
Sure, Michael. Really, we've identified that out there in the industry and in the world, there's three primary sources of a data breach. And these are broken down into organized criminals, well-meaning insiders, and malicious insiders. So malicious insider, really taking that one first, is someone who is either already working, a disgruntled employee at your company or organization, or it could be a former employee who still has access to systems and their access wasn't terminated correctly. We see this a lot with, you know, salespeople. Salespeople will typically leave an organization, and what do they take with them? They take their golden Rolodex, and that's typically going to be the account names, and they'll take that to their next organization, and that actually is a data breach. Then we have the well-meaning insider. Well-meaning insider is really not someone who is necessarily nefarious. They're not trying to cause a data breach, but they're not necessarily following the rules correctly or may not have been adequately trained on what the rules are and what the proper procedures are for securing information like EPHI. This, for example, could be someone who decides to go home and work for the weekend, and they take a spreadsheet of all of their latest claims and bills from their small practice, and they email it to their self on their Yahoo account. And then their Yahoo account, because it's not very secure, gets hacked into, which happens all the time. And now that data is out there in the wild. That certainly is a data breach, and that's what a well-meaning insider really is. Then we have the organized crime. And organized crime is really kind of two groups. It's the organized crime for the purpose of making money, and then it's really state-sponsored crime as well. So in this scenario, and one of the scenarios I'm going to walk through here, we're going to talk about this gentleman who's pictured here, Albert Gonzalez. And he is still one of the only individuals who has actually been caught and prosecuted for one of the largest credit card breaches of all time. It was over 130 million credit cards that were stolen from Heartland Payment Systems. So we'll go into, in the next step here, we're going to talk about, I'm going to use that scenario, that data breach, and kind of walk through what are some of the stages of a data breach. How does this actually happen? And there's four primary stages. The first stage there is, you know, pretty self-explanatory, is the incursion. In the situation with Heartland, there was actually two different ways that they were able to break in. One was by what we call war driving, where literally they were driving up and down the road with Wi-Fi antennas hanging out of the car and stealing Wi-Fi passwords to be able to jump onto corporate sites. The other way is through an actual targeted attack, against the website, and that used what was called a SQL injection. And basically, most web sites these days, web applications, are tied to a back-end database in some form or fashion. 9 times out of 10, you're going to see that it's going to be from a Microsoft SQL or a Postgres SQL, and there's some nifty little tools that you can actually use to be able to get those databases to allow you to have access. So they used both of those techniques to be able to get into the Heartland Payment Center data center, and were actually able to break in and then install some malware on the desktops of certain individuals within the organization. And that's when we move to the discovery phase. So at that point, they're kind of acting like I do as a security consultant. They are mapping out everything on the inside of the network, seeing what they can find, seeing what's unsecured, and that's the discovery phase. The next phase was, after they've identified what they want to steal, is the capture phase. And this is important because there are some pretty good technologies out there that allow you to be able to see bad things happening on your network, but a lot of the times they're not deployed correctly and they may not be monitored correctly. But either way, the hackers are taking really sneaky and appropriate measures to make sure that you don't find them. In fact, a recent study just came out that said the average time to detect a data breach in your organization is 243 days. So during that incursion phase, through the exfiltration phase, is really, you know, a lot of time that they're able to run around on your network. So the final part is the exfiltration phase. And this is where they are actually packaging up the data, and they'll encrypt it so that you can't see it. And then they'll send it out to remote servers that they control in the internet somewhere. The way they actually were able to determine that this breach even occurred at Heartland is because on a annual basis, they did a firewall review. Now, clearly, I think you should be doing a firewall review a lot more than on an annual basis. But on an annual basis, they did a firewall review, and they noticed that there was these small little encrypted packages being sent over to former Soviet Union bloc nations. And they said, well, we don't really have any connections over there. We're not doing any business over there. Why is this data leaving our network and going over there? And sure enough, that's when they brought in the FBI and were able to actually discover that they had had a data breach. In that situation, it was over 18 months.
Okay. Great. Pretty scary stuff that it takes that long to discover it.
It is shocking sometimes, really, how long it does take to discover that. In fact, with the most recent Premier Blue Cross incident, they determined that that initial incursion happened on May 5th of 2014. They did not discover it until January 29th of this year.
Wow.
So clearly there's some things that you can do to help protect yourself, and not necessarily everyone is or are doing the right things. And that's hopefully what we're going to get through here today. Like I said, when we were getting started here, what are some of these defensive shields that we can throw up? So as we get into the – no, go ahead. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, no, let's talk about those best practices. I think definitely the events of the last 90 days really has everyone's attention.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we are talking about data breaches within healthcare here. And so clearly the compliance initiative that covers healthcare, as everyone is aware, is HIPAA. HIPAA has both the security rule and the privacy rule. But HIPAA, when they established HIPAA, they tried to keep things on purpose a little vague because they didn't want to say you should use XYZ specific technology. They said, we're going to point to the organization within the federal government that establishes a lot of these best practices, and that's called NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So all throughout HIPAA, you will see references pointing back to NIST for best practices. Now, there's also an industry group called SANS, and SANS really took a look at what NIST had written in a very, you know, high-level government language, and they made it a little more practical and easy to understand. So best practices within information security typically rely on both the SANS model and the NIST model to help achieve security compliance. So ultimately, you know, one of the things that you're going to hear me say probably several times during this webinar is that HIPAA compliance does not necessarily equal total security for your EPHI. And I'll get into that a little bit more later as to why that is. But really our focus here is to take you above and beyond what is just absolutely required for HIPAA to actually move into a more secured state.
Great, Mike. Thanks. And, you know, it's really in the context of all of this for IT executives, it's quite a daunting challenge. I mean, they have to balance security, compliance, and then enabling users. In other words, they have to do their business and practice management. In a recent visit to my doctor, I was talking to him about his EMR migration, and he liked the availability of data and the fact that, you know, he could get to it easily, but his pain point was a lot of different passwords and logons to all these different systems at times. So it's probably a delicate balance for IT managers to navigate these waters.
It really is, and it's certainly, you know, risk is always a trade-off with a reward. So I think you and I have had several conversations around this, and, you know, one of the things I like to point to is the fact that I'm impressed that IT security spending as a percentage of overall IT spending has actually increased. In fact, it's doubled, but it only went from 2% to 2.5% to 5%. So I really don't think, you know, it's all about securing your data and being able to control your data. Your IT security spend really needs to increase there. So let's start talking about some of these defensive walls. Really what we're getting to here is that you need this concept of a layered approach to security, also referred to as defense in depth, a pretty standard military model that's now being applied to information security. And the SANS security model has really represented what they call their six major defensive walls. And the first defensive wall for protecting your data really starts at the application layer. There would be no vulnerabilities for hackers to exploit if all of our software was written 100% perfectly. Now, I don't think we're ever going to get to a perfect scenario, but we can certainly work to get better. And there's a concept called the secure software development lifecycle, and this is really all about testing your applications in an iterative approach as you're writing them to make sure that you're not leaving open any back doors that hackers could potentially use to get in. And so that's when we're talking about defensive wall number one, it's proactive software assurance, making sure the software doesn't have the holes that a hacker could use.
Right.
So moving beyond that, when we're talking about defensive wall number two, this is where we're blocking the attacks. Now we have a multi-layered approach. The first place we want to try to block those attacks is going to be at the network or at the perimeter of your organization. And we have a few key technologies that we would prefer to see in place to be able to do this there. First and foremost is your firewall. You got to have a good firewall. You've got to make sure that the firewall is up to date and managed correctly. You've got to have intrusion detection and or intrusion prevention. Because a firewall is great, but a firewall is like a lock on the door. Intrusion detection is the ability to tell if someone is actually trying to rattle that door to get inside and alerting you on that. Intrusion prevention takes it to a next level and actually will stop them from rattling on your door and trying to get inside. And then, of course, you know, there's a lack of security personnel out there to be able to actually take a look at all these events that are generated by these technologies and being able to adequately respond to them. So there's services called managed security services, which we highly recommend that our customers take a look at, and that's outsourcing that security.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, just to ask, I mean, in retrospect, for example, looking at the Target hack and the technologies that, I mean, they're an enterprise company. They've spent a significant investment in technology. But as reported by Brian Krebs, the HVAC vendor's credentials were used to access the point of sale systems. So would these technologies have blocked that attack?
Well, you know, that's very interesting because they actually had in Target had deployed all three of these technologies. So they had intrusion detection and prevention. They had pretty good firewalls. They even had an outsourced provider who was monitoring some of this. But then we're going to see this in another one of our defensive walls later. But they didn't have staff that was adequately trained to be able to respond to the events as they were notified. And as a result, they were overloaded with the number of events that they were receiving, and they, A, didn't know what to do about it, and, B, they just kind of gave up at that point. Now, clearly, those employees are probably not there anymore, and Target is looking into training their future staff. But, yeah, that's just one layer, and that's why we're talking about a layered defense approach with various defensive walls. They did have all of this, but no single technology is going to be able to stop anything.
Right, right. So they had technology there, but perhaps they didn't have a go team to manage it once they discovered it.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, great.
Okay, so moving beyond we still have this concept of moving from the perimeter inward. So once we've secured our perimeter, we need to secure our host. Now, a host can be your server, a host can be a laptop or a desktop. That's what we also refer to endpoints. And endpoint security is really dramatically changed over the last few years. I used to work at Symantec, and we used to say that we had a 95% efficacy rate. Meaning we could detect about 95% of the new things that came out, and we were seeing about 5,000 new viruses or malware come out per week. Well, Symantec's new CEO just late last year, came out and stated that antivirus as we know it is dead, and then we have to move to a more unified endpoint security. So it's really taking a lot of the concepts that we apply to the perimeter, and we're applying them directly to those various endpoints. So we're putting firewalls on the endpoints. We're putting intrusion detection and prevention on the endpoints, anti-malware, antivirus, content filtering. And it's really trying to secure that individual endpoint. Because one of the things we're starting to see is this notion of a perimeter kind of a road. You know, you're not always within inside your corporate campus. Sometimes you're taking your laptop and connecting up to Starbucks. So you want to make sure that you have those various endpoints that you're on your network completely secured as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. And, you know, having spent some years in the managed service provider space and the security space like yourself, it was pretty common to find new clients that we onboarded who didn't have an updated antivirus or anti-malware programs or any central way to manage all of that. And it's a pretty critical piece to have visibility into the entire IT inventory, as you alluded to earlier, Mike, where employees come and go and, you know, consultants can have access to things. And so it's just important to kind of lock that down and have you know, like you said, a layered approach to the defense to understand who can access what.
Exactly, and I'm glad you brought that up with the consultants, because that's the other piece of technology that we have on this slide, and that's network access control, or also referred to as NAC. And that's some technology that's been around for a while but still not widely deployed, but starting to pick up steam there. And basically what that does is, in most organizations, anybody can walk in with a laptop, plug right into the wall jack, and hop on the network. Network access control would actually prevent that. It would lock down the actual physical wall jacks to prevent only those computers which are allowed to connect to the network to be able to actually connect to them.
Great.
So our fourth wall of defense is eliminating security vulnerabilities. And this is really all about having a good security management practice in place and a security management program. It's one of the things that we typically look for a lot when we're conducting risk assessments as part of HIPAA, is making sure that organizations have a good security management program in place. And a good security management program will include all of these. Vulnerability management, which is proactively identifying vulnerabilities on your network that could potentially be exploited and allow EPHI to be breached. There's various technologies that do that. You might hear them as vulnerability assessments or vulnerability scans. Also, patch management. And patch management really goes hand in hand with vulnerability management, because a lot of the times what we identify in vulnerability analysis is that we have a Microsoft 2003 server that is missing a critical security update. And that critical security update needs to come in form of a patch, typically. So patch management and vulnerability management work very well together. And then penetration testing. And penetration testing is becoming more and more important, because unlike a risk assessment or a vulnerability scan, a penetration test will actually test the security controls that you have put in place. I do a lot of penetration tests. That's where I get hired to essentially act like a hacker to try to break into our organization's network, typically in healthcare, for the purpose of trying to access and steal EPHI. Now, I'm an ethical hacker. I'm a good guy, so I get paid to do that, to point out all the holes that could potentially be used to break through those security controls. But that's a really good example of what the real-world scenario would look like when you're dealing with a potential nefarious hacker out there. Okay, defense wall number five. This is safely supporting authorized users. So we're talking about encryption, we're talking about virtual private networks, and we're talking about data loss or data leakage prevention. So starting with encryption, this is very important within HIPAA. There are some specific security standards that talk about encryption. Now, they're addressable standards, and I won't go into the details around that. If someone has a question on the difference between addressable and required, we can take that offline. But that is an addressable standard, which basically means if you don't have another security control in place to prevent theft or access of the EPHI, you should certainly consider encrypting that data, both at rest, which is where it's sitting on the server, maybe on your database, and as it's in motion, such as when you would be accessing it in the cloud or through a solutions provider.
Right. And, you know, Mike, when it comes to – oh, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, when it comes to working with business associates, another consideration for practices and healthcare entities and covered entities is to be sure to have a conversation about that BA's process for, you know, how they protect and handle EPHI. For example, using updated TLS encryption and, as you mentioned, you know, encryption of data at rest and in motion, very much like we utilize for our EFAC Secure product for customers who require, you know, the enhanced security controls to protect EPHI.
No, that's great. Thanks for pointing that out. And it is really important to make sure that that is deployed correctly as well. There's been some specific vulnerabilities against the older version of SSL recently, and we're requiring everyone to migrate to a better version of TLS, and I know you guys are already doing that at EFAX, and that's great. A couple of other technologies that we have up here is VPNs. virtual private networks. If you need to have remote access into the corporate data, you should do that in a secure manner. That's what VPN does. It encrypts all that data as you're communicating remotely to your network. And that's really critical. I can't tell you how many times I've come across organizations will have RDP, which is Microsoft's Remote Desktop Protocol, which allows you to have a remote desktop into your network, totally open up to the world. And RDP is not secure, is not encrypted, and it is one of the leading attack vectors for hackers out there that are just looking for an easy way into your network. And then the last piece here is DLP. DLP is still a relatively new technology, although it has been around for a number of years. It took a little while to mature. We're starting to see a lot more deployments of this now. And data loss prevention is kind of the inverse of intrusion detection and prevention. So instead of monitoring your network for bad things trying to get in, data loss prevention is monitoring your network for the data you're trying to keep from getting out. So it's really taking an outside look in and saying, what is my critical data? Where does it live? Who's allowed to have access to it? And if it moves, adds, or changes, notify me and or prevent that from happening. So in our final
discussion.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Michael.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah, so our final defensive wall here is defensive wall number six, and this is really tools to manage security and maximize the effectiveness. So one of the critical things, and I think I point this out a little later on, but one of the areas where I see a lot of organizations not doing a very good job or simply not doing it at all is log management. Literally every type of computer system that connects to a network is capable of generating a log. And HIPAA requires specifically that you maintain audit trails of every time someone accesses, changes, or modifies EPHI. And you simply can't do that without turning on that log management capability. So the thought there is that you have some technology or service that is a centralized aggregation point for every one of the logs that is generated off of every device in your network so that you can actually have forensically viable information. And why that's important is because especially with all the data breaches that are happening in the healthcare space, one of the other requirements under the HIPAA security rule and the privacy rule is that if you have a suspected data breach, then you have to conduct a risk analysis for the purpose of determining a data breach, because you want to be able to determine exactly how many records were accessed so that you don't fall into that category where you have to assume that all of your records were accessed. And without having log management in place to be able to do a forensics analysis of that data breach, you're going to automatically fall into the category where you have to assume that 100% of everything on your network was accessed. So, and moving after, you know, kind of the next level of log management is what we call, I'm sorry, could you go back? I wasn't quite done there. So moving beyond log management is actually moving into SIEM technology, which is Security Incident and Event Management. It's really layering on some analytical capabilities to analyze all that log data that's being generated, specifically looking for security events. And then finally, we have training, and that's training your staff. That's really making sure that not only security awareness training, but also making sure those people who are responsible for the security of your network are adequately trained to deal with an incident response. So why are we looking at all these defensive walls? A few years ago, people said, I'm secure. I have a firewall, right? And well, firewalls just aren't enough. If we look at the chart here, we can, I won't spend too much time on this, but we can see that, just doing firewalls is not getting you close to 100%. When we look at NIDS here, NIDS stands for Network Intrusion Detection. That adds a much more significant piece of the pie. And then we look at OS, application, and database logs. once again, completing that pie. So we're trying to layer in all of these technologies to give us a much better capability to be able to actually detect, repel, and respond to a cyber attack.
So just having a firewall, whether it's a high-end or not, is not necessarily good enough.
Exactly. Some of the newer firewalls, the UTM devices, have incorporated some of this technology in there, but it's having that alone is simply not going to be good enough. Okay, so let's take a look at what are some of the common threats. We've looked at what are the sources of a data breach, how that happens. We've looked at talked about some of the risks. Now let's talk about what are some of the threats that are impacting the healthcare space specifically. We were just touching on that briefly with the firewalls that are not enough. It's security architecture. Firewalls and antivirus just are not enough to be able to really protect you against that cyber breach event in the modern space. Unpatched client-side software, that's going back to our defensive walls. That's security patch management and vulnerability management. And then advanced malware and ransomware. The latest version of CryptoWall has just been released, and I've had a lot of clients that have been dealing with this. And in case anyone doesn't know what that is, ransomware is where they actually install a piece of software, a piece of malware on your computer, and then they fully encrypt all of your data on that computer and any network shares that's attached to. So if it's attached to servers that have network shares, it's going to encrypt all that data too, which means you no longer have access to it. And the only way to get around that is to pay them a ransom. And that can range anywhere from $500 to $5,000. And I've seen, specifically healthcare customers who have made the decision, although I recommend against it, to pay that because their backups that they had to be able to restore from were over 24 hours old. So that meant they were going to lose an entire day of health charts. So that was very important to them to go ahead and recover that. I typically recommend that most customers don't do that because then, you're showing that you're a willing participant in the scheme at that point. And I guarantee you in a few weeks or a few months, it's probably going to happen to you again. And I do, in fact, have a couple of customers that it has happened multiple times because they decide to pay that ransom.
Yeah, the ransomware is a really nasty one, Mike. I've seen it as well in the financial industry, for example, where malware came in on a laptop and then, as you described, connected to a shared file server that had imaging data and encrypted the entire thing. And then, of course, asked them for a ransom. So this can really sink a business. Luckily, in that particular case, this client had a full backup offsite, but it's a big risk.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge risk. And in fact, the latest version of CryptoWall that just came out is even more concerning because we've identified that it is now also installing spyware, where before it was just encrypting the data and requiring you pay a ransom and wasn't actually looking at the data. Now we know for a fact that there are versions out there that are installing spyware, which means that could give access to EPHI. So now you have to, if you get a ransomware infection, you have to seriously take into consideration that you need to perform a risk assessment for the purpose of a data breach. So what are some of the other threats that are impacting us? Poor configuration management, cloud computing and storage, not making sure that you have the appropriate security controls in place there for data at rest and data in motion in the cloud. Unencrypted PHI and removable media. Until these recent healthcare data breaches, the actual number one vector for the cause of a EPHI disclosure was loss or theft of laptops, thumb drives, recordable media like CDs, DVRs. Now that's changing. We're seeing proactive hacks taking place there. Mobile devices and BYOD, clearly that's a new threat vector. I've been in several hospitals where we've had doctors sending texts back and forth to nurses and recommending treatment options for patients XYZ. Well, that's EPHI over an unencrypted non-secure communication, and that's a big no-no. And finally, botnets. Really, what has happened in the cyber space over the last few years is this growth of botnets. Now, botnet is literally, one way to think about it is you have one hacker who has now penetrated up to 1,000 computers, and he can remotely control all 1,000 of those computers to do his bidding. So in cases like what we saw just recently, where there was a brute force attack against some passwords, he was able not only to use one computer to try to run a bunch of attacks to guess passwords, but he used over 1,000 computers, and that reduced the amount of time it took for him to gain access significantly. So in addition to technology threats, we see business impacting threats. And Michael, I think you had some comments on this one that we were discussing the other day.
Yeah, absolutely. So having a breach and a reportable event, notifying your customers, the public, and the DHS can be a massive blow, obviously, to the business's reputation and financial viability. For example, as reported by Nielsen Hardiman, the Home Depot hack cost them $62 million on credit monitoring services for all the impacted individuals. And in addition, as a follow-on, the company spent $148 million in its second fiscal quarter following the Black Friday attack of 2013. So these costs can add up very quickly. Looking at a recent study that I read, Mike, by the Ponemon Institute, found that the average per capita cost of handling a data breach is $359 in the healthcare industry, and that is compared to $201 for other industries. So it's a significantly higher cost and stakes in the healthcare industry.
Absolutely, and I think you touched on that in one of our first slides at the beginning there, and why are the bad guys going after medical records? And it's because those medical records are more complete. You've got things like Social Security number, address, age, a lot of pertinent information about that individual. And on the cyber black market, where they're actually selling these identities, just selling a Social Security number or a credit card can get you about $5 to $10 per Social Security number or credit card. But if you can sell an entire identity, which you could get from a medical record, you're looking at upwards of $200 per record that they can sell that for.
Yeah, so significant. Do you want to cover the last couple pitfalls, Mike?
Yeah, let's cover those real quick because I know it looks like we've got some questions here. So let's talk about some of the common pitfalls that I've seen out there. This is just what I've seen 9 times out of 10 organizations are not dealing with appropriately. Number one, risk assessment. And that comes in a couple of different flavors. Either they're just not doing the risk assessment or they're doing the risk assessment and not doing it in the correct way because they weren't adequately trained or they didn't use an appropriate outsource provider who was adequately trained. So risk assessment's number one. That's what allows you to have a good roadmap of what to do within your organization to make you more secure and to make your EPHI more secure. Lack of accurate data inventory and controls. Once again, I talked about the log management, and it's the audit logs. That is critical for root cause analysis and forensics analysis. And then humans. Accidents happen, and social engineering has become one of the main vectors for breaking into organizations. We saw this just recently with the big Sony hack. I know that's not in the healthcare space, but it was a pretty significant hack, and social engineering was what was used there. Social engineering comes in several forms, but what most of us will recognize it as is phishing, and that's when someone sends you an email and tries to get you to click on something. And finally, security awareness training. Security awareness training is really a requirement of HIPAA, and it's not done enough from what I've seen out there, and that's training the end users to become a human firewall because the end users have typically been the weakest link in the chain.
Great. Thanks, Mike.
So a few more here, missing policies and procedures and not following your policies and procedures, and then not having that incident response team and plan and in place to be able to respond when you actually do have a data breach, because I think as everyone's seen, it's not a matter of if this is going to happen to you, it's when it's going to happen, and you want to make sure you have all of your plans in place of how to respond to it when it does.
Great, and definitely having an incident response team, is a critical component, so that entities can take a proactive approach, to enhance their ability to react quickly and enable faster reporting to appropriate federal and state authorities.
Exactly. And this is my favorite one. This is the most common pitfall of them all, and it's passwords. It's, we are locked into a password-centric world, but some of the passwords out there that are still being used today, whether it's having a bad password or having a bad password policy that allows you to have that bad password or writing down those passwords, this is certainly one of the biggest common pitfalls out there. What we're looking at here is what's called a password cloud. So there was some analysis that was done against some passwords which were breached off of a dating site out of Australia. There was over 110,000 user accounts that were stolen and then made public by the hackers. And a security analyst took that and he compared it against what are the 10,000 most common passwords used. And what we found there was 40% of that user base in those 110,000 accounts had a password that was in the top 100. And if you're looking at that cloud there, that's, the most common password was password. Next one was 123456, then 123456789. So a lot of these were very commonly used. 79% had a password that were in the top 500, and 91% had a password that was in the top 1,000. Now, that's pointing out that those are bad passwords, but it's pointing out a second thing there, too. You may have heard me talk about brute force or a dictionary-style attack. That's where a hacker is trying to guess your username and password, and he's using computational power, whether in his botnet or in his computer, to be able to do that. And if he loads up those top 1,000 passwords and knowing that he's going to have a better than a 90% chance of getting someone's account with one of those passwords, it's going to significantly reduce the amount of time it takes for him to break in. So all of this we've been talking about with the healthcare and HIPAA compliance, and I think I said this at the beginning, I'm a big proponent of taking a look at this from a perspective that compliance does not equal security. If you look at what happened at Target, if you look at what happened to Heartland Payment Systems and several other organizations recently, Target was PCI compliant, which is the payment card industry standard. They were GLBA compliant because they have financial transactions. They were Sarbanes-Oxley compliant because they are a publicly traded company. And they were HIPAA compliant because they have a pharmacy. So they had all of those compliances in place, yet bad things still happened and they had a major data breach. So compliance does not equal security because typically compliance is a post-mortem concept. In other words, something bad happened. We write a rule or an initiative or a standard to try to keep that one bad thing from happening again, and it's dealing with yesterday's threats. It's not dealing with the future threats. So hopefully throughout this presentation today and this webinar today, we've given everyone some idea that, there's some deeper things you can do within your security practice to better protect the EPHI that you're responsible for.
Okay, let's transition a bit. We have a couple more slides to share here, and then we can get to our Q&A. Just real quick, wanted to discuss transmission of EPHI over fax and some trends in the industry today. So as you may know, faxing is still widely used in the healthcare industry, from transmission of EPHI from a doctor's office to a medical device manufacturer, or faxing of claims, for example, containing PHI to an insurance provider. In fact, recent research from Davidson Consulting shows that enterprise growth for fax will be at a healthy 15% clip from 2015 to 2017 as it remains the primary method for transmitting sensitive data. The other trend is fax technology continuing to move to cloud faxing from on-premise server-based faxing as companies are realizing the benefits of scalability, reliability, security, and the reduced cost of cloud faxing. And just a quick word about eFax Corporate. So we are the world's number one online fax company and the industry's most experienced hosted fax service, the most widely used and deployed online fax service for the Fortune 500, and trusted by more healthcare, legal, financial, and other highly regulated firms than any other online fax provider to transmit sensitive documents. And just a quick mention about eFax Secure. eFax Secure is one of those products that under the eFax corporate portfolio that offers a highly secure and reliable email-driven faxing with no hardware or software required. So before we jump into our Q&A, we wanted to share some helpful links. And as Carol mentioned in the beginning, the recorded slides of our presentation will be shared with you via email. In addition to the white paper, is cloud-based faxing right for you? And for additional information on eFax Corporate, visit enterprise.efax.com. I want to thank everyone for their time today. I know we've gone over a little bit, but we've got a lot of questions coming in. So Carol, I'd like to hand it over to you for the Q&A.
Yeah, no worries, no worries. Yeah, we got a little over, but you know, it's a complicated topic. So no surprise. A lot of people asking for the slide deck again. Just a reminder that you will get that along with recording within the next 24 hours. So I'm going to just go ahead and cherry pick a couple questions to try to get to the next 5 minutes or so, if that works for you. Do either of you know of any specific vulnerability associated with two-step validation? Mike, I know that that's a question that was answered on a webinar a couple weeks ago. So obviously a lot of practices out there use that two-step validation to try to eliminate, if they can, the hacking process.
Yeah, and two-factor authentication and validation there is important, and that's a great step forward. I've seen many physical vulnerabilities around that where someone will actually leave their key fob or leave their proximity card. And in fact, a friend of mine just did a presentation and is doing another one this summer at Black Hat, which is the national hackers conference that's held in Las Vegas every summer, where he demonstrated that with a backpack device, he could walk around a facility and be able to capture everyone's proximity card information or key fob information to actually utilize the vulnerability built into the system to escalate his privileges so that he could actually bypass some of the two-factor authentication itself.
Another common question we get quite a bit is how secure is email? From a medical practice saying we avoid sending emails to patients, but sometimes that is the only and or the best way to reach them.
Sure. I'll let Michael give a shameless plug for eFax because they could obviously fax them secure, much more securely than email. Email in and of itself is 100% insecure unless you are using a
yes.
specific email encryption service. Email is in what we call clear text, so anybody can read any email that goes across the internet. And in fact, if you're sending patient data across there, then that does constitute a potential data breach.
Yeah, absolutely. So encryption at rest and in motion. So we have obviously a solution for that we talked about, and the primary thing there is to make the data useless for the cyber criminals.
All right. Another pretty common question related to BYOD, bring your own device. What security measures can be applied successfully for BYOD? Any sample policies to share?
Sure. One of the most common things that you can actually deploy is the ability to remotely wipe it. A lot of people and a lot of end users give some pushback on there. But I take a pretty strong stance on that in organizations that I help put their policies in place for. And that's, of the notion that if, we're allowing you to bring your own device and you're agreeing to that, if you are going to access corporate information with your own device, then we have the right to remotely wipe that device in the event that it is lost or stolen. And we put that in the policies and procedures, and we also put it in our sanction policy and our termination policies to make sure that, if you don't notify us within an appropriate amount of time, then that could be a what I call a resume-generating event.
Right, right. Another pretty common question has to do with remote login, the applications where you can remotely log in your desktop. One of the attendees uses Log Me In. Is it safe to log in your desktop from an offsite using one of these remote applications?
I think it's relatively safe, depending upon what you're doing there. Like Log Me In, I would not recommend, because you're actually going through a third party. So that means the data that you're accessing actually hits their servers first before it is presented to your desktop. And if you have not signed a business associate agreement with that end user, with that organization, then you could be at risk there. There are better solutions that are more secure for doing that. You can do that with several Microsoft products, Citrix products. There's a lot out there, but I would not. Log Me In is really meant to be a consumer grade product. It's not an enterprise class product.
Right. Got it. Yeah. And question for you, Michael. Does eFax Corporate provide an API that can integrate into an EHR platform for fax transmittals?
Yeah, thanks, Carol. So actually, it's a very good question. eFax Corporate does have API solutions that can integrate into EMRs, and we're working with several covered entities and providers to help them with their electronic faxing through an API.
Another probably question for you and for Mike as well. Do you have a recommendation for a third-party encryption email software for an Exchange server? Obviously, Exchange servers are huge right now with people having, emails on multiple devices that they're looking to coordinate in one place.
Sure. I don't want to recommend any specific one product. What I would suggest, though, is there are several out there that are very good, and there's several reviews that have already been done on those, so we don't have to go over that again. But I would certainly make sure the first question I would ask them is, are they willing to sign a business associate agreement?
Right. Will they sign a BA? Right.
Yep.
Great question. Any advice for a small one-doc practice? Obviously, Mike, you had mentioned you're seeing, albeit probably not enough, IT security budgets going up, I'm sure, on the enterprise level. But what about a small one-doc practice? What does a solo practitioner do?
That's a great question. And it's tricky because HIPAA does not specifically distinguish between size. HIPAA does not care if you are a single doc or multi-thousand doc site. So you still have to do everything that's necessary to protect the EPHI. In that scenario, you have to take a look at risks and where do you trade off risks. And that's where it really comes into play to working with really good service providers, whether it's a cloud-hosted EMR or it's an eFax solution for faxing or an outsourced provider for your email. I would certainly look at going with one of those or several different outsourced providers to take care of your technology solutions and, once again, to make sure you have business associate agreements assigned with those.
Yeah, that's a great segue into my next question. And sorry, I'm pulling through these, trying to get as many as I can in. You say that email is not secure, but Microsoft is willing to sign a BA for Office 365. Is that secure enough?
I didn't know
that Microsoft was willing to sign a BA, to be honest with you, but
Yeah, that's relatively new. They in the past were not, but they have just come out to say that they are certainly willing to do that now for Office 365. That's because that's a cloud-based email solution. Now, when I say that email is not secure, basically what Microsoft is saying there is that as long as the email is sitting on our servers, we will keep it secure. But if you still send an email to somebody else and it hits somebody else's server, you're sending email in an unsecured, unencrypted way. So it's still just using standard email technology to do that. But Microsoft is saying as long as it's sitting here on our servers and you're accessing it through the web browser or through the Outlook 365 client, it is secure, but it is as soon as it leaves our servers, we're not responsible for it anymore, and it's no longer secure.
Right. Got it. What about, there's a number of, obviously, free malware scanning software products out there. One of the attendants wanted to know is that acceptable for a business to use?
I would not recommend using anything free. Yeah, I would
you get
in fact,
what you pay for. Yeah, I figured that was your answer.
Yep, you get what you pay for. I would look at enterprise class. It's gonna be a little more expensive, but you're gonna get, like I said before, antivirus is dead. Traditional antivirus is dead, so you really need that multi-layered approach to your endpoint security, and you're not gonna get that from a free client. You're only gonna get that from an enterprise class piece of technology, whether it's Symantec, Trend Micro, CA. That's what I would look at.
Obviously, consumers use these three products all the time, but for your business, right? Is there a program or encryption system you would recommend to encrypt email? Right up your guys' alley.
Yeah, I think that was kind of a duplicate to another one we had there. That I'm not going to recommend any specific program, but certainly make sure that there is one. If you don't want to use it as a service, an encrypted service, you can certainly download. It's a program called PGP, which is a standalone application, and it is free, and it works very well for a free application. It's just the person on the other end you're sending it to, they also have to have PGP to decrypt that email.
Right. All right. So, again, we've got more questions waiting, and if we didn't get to your question, excuse me, Mike and Michael, we will get them answered to you via email. We won't encrypt it either. It'll be a text email to give you the answer. To reach Michael and Mike directly, we provided their email addresses on this slide. So get a hold of them if you have a question we didn't get to, or something pops up later in the day or in the next week or so after you see the presentation. Please reach out to them directly. They are graciously providing their emails. Michael, Mike, thanks for today's event. Great topic, great presentation, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about cybersecurity and hacking in the next few months, and perhaps we can even redo this event again.
Great, thank you very much.
For attending.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the eFax Corporate Podcast. Please visit our website, enterprise.efax.com, for additional podcast episodes as well as other resources to help you make the best informed decision about your fax service. We welcome your questions, comments, and suggestions for future podcast topics at corporatesupport@mail.efax.com.